netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for taking the time to download our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Our subject today is going to be on Thor, and we'll be speaking with Kelly Port from Digital Domain. Before I get to that, I just want to thank everyone who came up and said hi when I was at Stuttgart for FMX last week. Really such a great conference, really high-quality speakers, lots of great papers, and even presentations by various manufacturers. But honestly, it was just great to talk to those of you who came up to me and said you appreciate what we're doing at FX Guide and FX PhD. And a special thanks to those of you who are part of our FX Insider program. Basically, it's a program designed to just help us improve the quality of the content we have, increase the amount of content that we have here on the site. In fact, recently we hired Ian Fales full-time in our Sydney office to help us out. You'll actually see him for the first time on camera in our FX Guide TV app that's coming out shortly. But again, it means a lot for us because, you know, you really can't make a lot off advertising on the web, and we don't want to have, like, advertising plastered all over our site. We try and keep it minimally. So again, thanks to those of you who are contributing through the FX Insider program. We really do appreciate it. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking about Thor this week. And again, it's Digital Domain's work on the Ice Giants. We're only talking, discussing one setup effectively as part of this podcast. It opened in the United States last weekend, about, I think it was $65 million or so. It had actually been out a couple weeks before internationally. Kind of unusual for a film to be released internationally, but I think that kind of helped get a little buzz going, because at least a lot of the feedback I've heard from most of you who've watched it has been quite positive regarding the film. So why don't we go ahead and join that conversation now. It's Mike Seymour speaking with Digital Domain VFX supervisor Kelly Port.
I guess the interesting thing about creating a world that no one's ever seen before is there's no necessarily right or wrong. Did it take long to develop up the look of what you're going to be going with in this film?
Yeah, it actually did. One of the big focuses of Kenneth Branagh and Wesley Sewell, the studio side visual effects supervisor, was to create this world that was, when they got there, so awe-inspiring and huge that it was essentially the characters Thor and the Aesir, when they first arrive, is sort of this impression of what have we gotten ourselves into. So it was a once sort of grand world full of amazing architecture, and it's long since, after thousands of years, kind of fallen into disrepair, and it's essentially a planet that's dying and falling, literally falling apart. And so we went through quite a few sort of iterations of both in terms of what kind of architectural style they would necessarily have, and to distinguish it from Asgard, of course, but also to kind of create the scope of what they were looking at.
Yeah, well, obviously, you have a director with a huge sort of Shakespearean pedigree, and that's terrific. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting drama there. But when it comes to the visual effects, I just wanted to approach something slightly different, which is I was really curious to know whether you came up with kind of a playbook of the laws of gravity or the playbook of the laws of physics in this world, because you're describing not only an aesthetically interesting place, but a species that doesn't necessarily have to conform to any kind of pre-existing ideas. And there's obviously no reason why gravity needs to be exactly the same as it is here on planet Earth. So do you have to sort of set up for the team a kind of a rule book, or was that done for you? I mean, how does that come about?
As far as gravity goes, I think we, from the get-go, because so much of it was shot on yes, there's a lot of green screen, but they had created a good chunk of the main palace plaza where they have the conversation with Laufey, and so there's a lot of sort of established gravity, if you will, so we weren't kind of playing with that in any sense of it. The one sense that we did kind of play with that a little bit was with the design of the creature, that, you know, the frost beast creature, and it's chasing them, and it ends up kind of going underneath them, that we've sort of established this planet as sort of melting from within and dying, and so it has lots of hollows in and out of the surface, and so of caves and caverns. And so, you know, there's a section where it's about to attack them and it falls underneath, and then you see a big shot, just an enormous kind of helicopter type shot going underneath them, and you see the creature kind of running upside down. And sort of, it was sort of a known cheat, but it sort of worked in the context of the sequence.
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? I mean, it does give you a latitude to do that kind of stuff, because I really liked that it went through and then it was running upside down under the thing. I mean, I thought it was like a nice touch, but also it was threatening because you couldn't just get rid of the darn thing by dropping it into a hole, which, of course, in many films, you know, that's your solution to a big monster, make him fall through something. And so you're given that freedom, but by the same token, before we get into like how you pulled it off, it just seemed to me that if I was sort of briefing a team, I'd be like, well, this is what it can do, this is what it can't do, because in one sense it could do anything, and in another, you don't want the audience to just have a feeling that, well, anything's possible and nothing is at peril because it's all kind of fake.
Right. Well, we didn't have any sort of like overall brief like that. I think it was the whole scope of that sequence started off in one kind of essentially a smaller scope at the beginning of when we originally acquired the work, and expanded quite dramatically into something else. And so we, along with Third Floor, which is the production company's essentially Marvel's in-house previous team, and we after working with them for a little bit, we had brought in a few other previous guys and kind of messed around with the sequence a little bit and kind of played with what we could do to kind of extend that out and make it more exciting. And so we worked together with those guys to do that. And not only just in terms of, you know, the action of it, but also going back and forth with Marvel about the architecture. And that was a big thing for them, you know, getting this sort of look of the architecture, these towering, decaying bits of architecture that were once grand. And you can literally see these pieces falling apart, you know.
So let's discuss like how you go about realizing that. So I know the guys at Third Floor in LA, I've been to their place, and they seem to be very good at producing realistic camera sort of solutions that would feed into the pipeline. I say realistic in the sense that they don't do massive sort of cheats that when you come to try and realize it in 3D seem impossible. Was that your experience? Would you get handed assets that were valid, or did you just have to recreate everything and kind of guess how they pulled it off for the previews?
Yeah, I think as far as the stuff that we got, it was at a different scale than we're working in meters. So we had to, it wasn't quite a one-off a clean handoff, but you know, we definitely used some of their assets for quick, you know, previs and things like that. And of course, we had to build, you know, higher res production models for the finished look.
So let's discuss the sequence. The hammer comes into play, and the monster comes out, and then there's that sort of basically run to exit. And I was just wondering, like, from a Sims point of view, from a construction point of view, was that a massive build with pre-breaks for a lot of what was going on? I mean, how did you go about sort of doing that? Because it wasn't just a matter of doing sort of random dusty type snowy Sims. It was lots of fracturing and stuff.
Yeah, those are a big deal. For all those rigid body dynamic Sims, we had to build models that could be fractured without, you know, breaking the fracturing algorithms. And so essentially you went from a model that would sometimes take, let's say, 1 or 2 weeks into a 6 or 8 week build. And that's one big difference why the modeling took longer on those. We'd identify the specific buildings and terrain that would collapse or break. And so we'd have to kind of make sure that we had no intersecting vertices and things like that on all those. But in addition to that, we also did the prologue sequence, which shows Jotunheim prior to this millennia of decay, and essentially had to show those same buildings in a state, in a more pristine state. Granted, they're after sort of a battle and a war with Odin and his army, but they're different buildings. And so we had to kind of build two variations of these, and not only those, we had to identify the ones that needed to be fractured and put into the Sims as well.
Did you pick up the work pre or post the Odin battle sequence at the very beginning of the film? Like, in other words, did you, because there was like the sort of massive army shots of the, where was that?
Well, we did that work as well.
Yeah.
That was about 85 shots, and that was a huge amount of work in terms of the, it was a few shots, but they were very intense shots. You know, you got the frost giants arriving via the Bifrost. You've got this casket of winter's weapon, essentially like super cooled air blowing ice off the lake and essentially blowing into the village, destroying the village, engulfing the villagers. Odin arriving with his army, the ensuing battle. The arrival on the establishing shot of Jotunheim with the battle, and we did a few shots kind of in the on Asgard too, within the hallway where the Casket of Winters is kept. So anytime you see a sort of a frost giant or effects on Jotunheim, that's most of the stuff that we did.
I must say I enjoyed the shot. I think it was a side shot as the sort of ice mist hits the town in the prelude, and it's kind of rushes through, and that was like was a very nice and dramatic shot. And I remember thinking at the time there was quite a lot of interaction going on there between what you guys must have done and what's been done on set.
Yeah, and that was the tricky thing there was that we had to do a lot of you know, liquid simulation, but we also had to have the end result when it freezes into sort of a we want it to freeze into a position that's sort of established, not necessarily for continuity reasons, but for just a look reason. We want this kind of icy, jagged, dangerous-looking ice scape sort of designed to be in a certain way. And so, obviously, you're running a simulation. You can't just make it do that. You know, you have to, a simulation, by definition, just does what it wants to do. And so we kind of had to figure out ways to essentially force it into these positions by kind of creating blend shapes and a variety of different techniques to kind of force it into that. So that was a big challenge there, too.
It's ironic, isn't it? The more the simulations become accurate simulations, the more that it's also poses the problem of controlling them and just getting them to behave the way you want, which is half the reason why things get done in CG in the first place, is so you've got more control over them.
Right. Yeah. So, while simulations are great, they're super time-consuming, computationally intensive, and there's a lot of control that's kind of taken out of your hands. So I think hopefully we'll see more tools that will hopefully kind of provide parameters that you can kind of tweak simulations to kind of force them to do more what you want in the future.
Do you take the liberty of like combining multiple sims, or do you, is it just too hard to sort of connect the bridges?
If you can do that if it's not too obvious that they're intersecting, like if you can do it kind of in layers. But you have to be careful because they, if they're not aware of each other, they just will look like essentially they're comped together.
Because the big problem with the monster sort of sequence is a lot of that fractured geometry just can't afford to intersect itself, because there's no room for that happening, because it's meant to be brittle, and obviously the second it looks like it's going to intersect, you'd expect it to shatter.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to be very careful of that kind of stuff. And if it does, you have to just rerun the whole sim.
Yeah, fairly unforgiving.
But that came in, that prologue sequence came into play a little bit later, where they felt they needed to play a little bit more backstory on it. So our team, and actually most of the work that we did was based out of Vancouver. So we did about 337 shots in the film, and I think about 250 or so were done in Vancouver facility. And then we did this prologue sequence in Venice, which is about, with a few other shots, including a few Jotunheim battle shots here and there in our Venice studio.
So that splitting of the work, I'll come back to the geometry in a second. I just want to pick up on that. That splitting of the work is fairly seamless inside DD, isn't it? In the sense that you basically sync up overnight. It's not like they're basically doing complete shots and you're running as one facility, and it's almost fairly seamless, isn't it, between the two places?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, actually. We have, it's synced up every 15 minutes. As far as the, not necessarily the network tree, but the essentially what's shot to what we call our, it's a proprietary sort of organizational tool for viewing. And so if you want to send something to dailies, you send it to this, and all that is synced up through, the facilities and synced every 15 minutes, which is great. And Thor was really the first production. I mean, Vancouver facility was up and running around January 2009, and so they worked on Tron. But I would say Thor was probably the first production that we've actually started from the ground up, meaning development, look development, effects R&D. Essentially, they were the main facility for Digital Domain between Vancouver and Venice. And so it was definitely a testing bed for us, and very successful. And I think we ended up with a great team. And Eric Fernandez, who is the CG supervisor, Mark Richardson was the comp supervisor up there, and those guys did a great job.
I mean, people might think that it's kind of a simple thing just to sync every 15 minutes. But, for example, you probably don't want to be syncing SIM data, or you'd have gigabytes of data moving between the countries every 15 minutes.
No, and we did had to, you know, we synced certain assets like models where we were sharing shots. For example, we had to have a lot of the same buildings on Jotunheim, so Venice was doing a few shots on Jotunheim too. So we had to sync some of those things up, but we tried to keep it just like as if you were outsourcing to any other facility in India or wherever you may be collaborating. You obviously want to try to keep it as separate as possible just for efficiency's sake, but nowadays it transfers pretty fast, and it's not too big of a deal if you have to do that.
So let's get back to the geometry for a second, and this idea of having like a pre-collapse society and a post-collapse society geometry, and them needing to be visually the same but obviously quite different. Did you go about that by trying to model a fundamental building that could then be taken in either direction? Or was it literally, let's just make two complete versions and let them look like each other?
Yeah, we started off with the broken one. And the idea was that because of the way the set was designed, the live action set, had a lot of these sort of vertical array of these smaller columns. And this was supposed to be essentially the eroded or the destroyed version of Jotunheim. And the idea that came up with is that originally the more pristine version of these buildings had an exterior that was a little bit more refined and smooth. And then as this over time eroded, it would reveal the substructure of these vertical columns underneath. And so as we built the pristine versions, we'd simply take the sort of more eroded ones and create and basically add on the smoother exterior surface to it. And probably have to add a little bit of more architectural ornamentation and things like that here and there as well.
So interestingly, for a film that was going to end up as a stereo conversion and stuff, but also a strong visual effects film, this was actually shot on film, wasn't it? It was actually shot on Kodak stock.
Yeah, and anamorphic as well.
Really? So did that affect you at all in terms of getting those CG set extensions and sort of stuff all integrated, or is that pretty much a solved problem for you?
That's pretty much a solved problem at this stage. I mean, anamorphic is sort of a pain to work with, and it kind of always has been, but I mean, we've dealt with it so often now that it's kind of we have all the tools at our disposal to deal with that. In terms of, you know, lens mapping and things like that, these are all things that are sort of a standard procedure at the beginnings of shows and shooting grids and getting all the hype lenses classified and things like that.
Did you have any considerations for an eventual stereo production?
Well, we actually, with working with Marvel, we kind of categorized our stereo deliveries into a few different types. We had a type one, which is essentially, we didn't do anything. That'd be akin to the same, Stereo D, by the way, was the company that was responsible for dimensionalizing. And this would be akin to a non-visual effect shot, just a live-action shot. So if we had one of those, which I don't think we did, actually, but we would hand that over to them and without any sort of helper elements or anything like that. A Type 2 would be essentially an all-CG shot. And in that case, and there's actually quite a few of them in the Jotunheim sequence, I think around 80 shots, are actually true stereo. So we would actually give a left and a right eye, and that wasn't essentially dimensionalized at all. It was real stereo.
Mm-hmm.
And a third type was where we would give them helper elements. So anything that we had that could be useful, for example, one of the big challenges in dimensionalizing is atmospheric. So snow atmosphere, which every single shot on that sequence had, we would give them what we had for the composite. So typically a standard element delivered to the compositor on the Jotunheim sequence would be a background, midground, and foreground snow. Same with atmosphere, background, foreground, midground atmosphere. Any roto that we had, any green screen keys, Z-depth information if we had it, anything like that. And then we'd deliver that as layers to Stereo D to help them in their process of dimensionalizing. And the last type was if, let's say it had a live-action component, foreground Thor or gang, and they Stereo D would dimensionalize that, give us back a camera, and then we would incorporate that into our background and give left it full, basically give them back a full actual stereo shot.
Right. So I digress there for a second because I was curious about that pipe from production. But if we go back to now the plates that you've got the geometry sorted. You've got this large character creature that's going to interact with your geometry, especially in terms of the simulations of the fracturing and stuff. For that to work really well, of course, you need the dimensions and the actual character shapes to be pretty much locked off, because obviously you can't be running a dummy geometry through a sim and then have the thing double or halve in size. So was the creature itself, the frost creature, locked down fairly early on in terms of its actual physicality?
Well, it went through a design process and you know, that all happened kind of consecutively in the proper order. Like we would have, this was all our units were in meters, and so all of our designs and the sets and all the information that we get from the live action set is all in the same units. And so as we design our creature, it's all in the same units. And so it all kind of fit in naturally.
And was there anything in terms of actually getting those final shots done that, because you've got the fractured geometry and, of course, the creature stuff to interact with it, it was still a really nice sequence in terms of just a lot of stuff going on and also keeping sort of orientated, given that some of it was upside down, so that you actually knew who was in peril. Because I think I personally have a problem with those action sequences where you sort of lose the geography of it, especially when it's something unfamiliar, like an alien planet where you sort of, you know, not running down a street where you can kind of tell what's going on.
Right. Well, all of those sims that did have to interact with the creature, the creature geometry itself was in the sim itself. So,
okay.
And so there's a few big shots where you know it's breaking out of the ice and running along the ice and all that kind of stuff, and then the floor collapsing. And there's a few separate sims, but a lot of those were run together because they just needed to be. But that all came together really well, I think. I love that big shot with it going into the cave. It's one of my favorites in the whole movie.
Yeah, I like it as well. Yeah, it was pretty effective. The obviously the live action elements were composited, and I presume this was a nuke pipeline for compositing.
Definitely. Yep. Yeah, and we took what we kind of learned off the Tron 3D side of it and incorporated that, of course. And we're always kind of developing new tricks and tools from Nuke, and it's been a good relationship with the Foundry as they've kind of taken over that. And it's great to see Nuke kind of get out there more, which is fantastic.
Fan. Apart from anything else, it would help you, I presume, in hiring freelancers or a team to sort of tool up for a project, because a wider sort of base of talent makes for an easier team assembly.
That's been a huge help, actually, yeah.
So tell me about the team. Sort of how big was your 3D team and how big was the compositing team on this set of shots?
We also had a big animation team too. We had probably about 15, 20 animators on this too, led by Eric Petey up in Vancouver. And that's, we did a lot of motion capture, but there was also a lot of keyframe animation, especially obviously with the beasts, which was an interesting challenge actually, because it was, sort of anatomically, designed as a sort of a cat-like body. But it, they wanted it to sort of run like more like a rhino, kind of charging through anything in its path, busting through stuff, sort of this endless energy and focus of just, I'm going to get you guys, and that's it. So that was a cool challenge to have. We probably had about 150 total crew size on this. Not sure exactly what how the 3D, 2D, I think we ended up with probably 60 or so compositors on this. I know one thing that's always struck me as far as the rendering times on this, rendering hours, I think we calculated about 2.5 million render hours on this one.
Wow.
Between the two facilities, I should say.
Do both facilities have render farms, or is the rendering done out of Venice?
They both do, yes, but we also had off-site stuff working for us as well.
Right.
I know we simply just don't have the power to do it. There's not enough electricity to deal with some of these things, so you have to kind of go off-site a little bit.
So I'm curious, the sort of construction, you said you learned lessons from Tron that you took forward into this. Were there lessons from this that you would take forward into the next project?
I think so. There's a lot of the things that you learn on a show-to-show basis, or things like, one of the difficulties we had or challenges we had was just getting things in the, from one package to another. Especially, with the Sims and being able to, this was a huge, huge challenge as far as, you've seen some of these Sims, and it's just an enormous amount of data. And all of this terrain had a look development that was done in Maya and out of Mudbox or ZBrush and Photoshop, and you have these, with the end result being rendered in RenderMan. And this whole kind of look development process, which is pretty standard, and that has to go through back to Houdini, where it's, you have to verify that all the vertices aren't intersecting, you have to fracture it, make sure the UVs are intact, and that has to go back out to get rendered again without all the UVs being all screwed up and stuff. And when you're talking about just an enormous amount of geometry, it's a huge challenge to make sure that you don't want to have to reassign manually shaders.
Yeah. And in terms of the color workflow, because the Ice Planet was so dark and gloomy and blue, but obviously you were shooting green screen, I presume that it wasn't that heavily lit in the actual plate photography. But were you delivering a kind of combined look, or was it really like passing over stuff that had a huge amount of latitude so that a lot of that could be added in the DI?
Well, we delivered with stuff with a lot of latitude for sure, with the knowledge that, you know, they'll have room to dial this stuff in DI and to an extent that they need to. Having said that, we did take it to a bluer and as close to what we wanted or what Marvel wanted as an end result, so that we didn't, because we knew we were taking it quite a bit darker and bluer for this environment, we wanted to be sure that this is where they wanted to go. So even though they had room to change it, but when you start to go a little bit more monochromatic with the blue, you're in danger of not getting be able to get that back to some degree. So so that is kind of the look that they were going for in that, and so we didn't want to go. It's hard for us to work in a state where it's just a purely neutral. You know, it's nice to be able to look and react to the footage in as close to a medium that it's going to be at the end result as it plays in the theater as much as you can.
Because it really was dark. I mean, it was like really gloomy dark, especially after the collapse of the society. And so there was sense of detail in the blacks, don't get me wrong, but it was like, it wasn't blue, I guess it was like a kind of an aqua tonality, but it was very monochromatically dense.
Yeah. Well, you know, they actually, it did go a little bit darker than the stuff that we were delivering, but it is meant to be sort of and I'm sure the 3D glasses don't help from that extent.
No.
Either.
No.
And then a lot of times, you know, certain things that you don't have control of, like the projector in the theater, you know, if it's not to spec or it's not bright enough, typically you compensate for that kind of brightness in the DI if it's a stereo delivery. You brighten it up, compensate for the glasses.
I certainly saw it in stereo in an environment with a good projection, because obviously the irony is that in contrast to your dark and gloomy ice world is a, you know, a lot of desert sequences down on Earth, which are sort of super bright, and I guess you know, there are other worlds halfway in between. But nevertheless, I guess there must be some part of you that, like, if you see a final grade that's crushed it down, it goes, oh, man, I spent hours modeling that thing in the back and I can't even see it now.
No, it's cool. I thought it looked all right. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. The screening I saw actually looked pretty good. So,
yeah.
It was sort of, it was a little bit darker than I expected, but definitely within the realm of what I was expecting.
Yeah, well, it's certainly part of now that growing kind of momentum of movies as part of the series, and so it's been interesting to see how it all comes together. But yeah, I really enjoyed your work, and so thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
We actually have more coverage online. There's a written article about the work from Digital Domain, and so check out FX Guide for that, obviously. And also I mentioned that I was in Stuttgart last week. We're going to be covering some of the open source announcements that took place there. Disney announced some new initiatives. Goetia announced they're adding the deep compositing or deep opacity component of OpenEXR 2.0. We talked to Sebastian Schilwan, who's the Chief Technology Officer at Weta Digital, and we also kind of got an update about Katana from the founder, kind of an overview of what Katana is, because I think it's been kind of somewhat difficult to explain, and we saw a really good presentation from Sony Pictures Image Work about that, so be on the lookout for that in the coming days at FX Guide. As always, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to drop us a line. Links are on the website. And as always, for my partners Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.